Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Although California spends almost $9 billion a year on its correctional system, there is widespread evidence that our prisons are not working to rehabilitate criminals or prevent repeat offenses. In fact, about 65% of all paroled prisoners in California end up back in custody within 3 years. This is the highest rate, by the way, of recidivism in the United States. So why do prisoners come out of jail yet continue a life of crime? What does it take for a convicted criminal to renounce violence and create a new way of living? How can California's prisons stop the revolving door and reduce repeat offenders? Tonight, we look at an innovative program that is helping prisoners break the cycle of violence and create a life without crime as we look at the GRIP program at San Quentin State Prison. GRIP, which stands for Guiding Rage into Power, is forging a new model for prisoner rehabilitation and having a powerful impact on the men who graduate from the program. And joining us in the studio tonight are three guests who are closely involved with the program. First, we have Jacques Verdun. He's a psychologist, community organizer, and teacher. He is the founding director of the GRIP program, which trains prisoners in mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and transforming violence. He has worked in prisons for 16 years and serves as a catalyst for statewide prison reform in California. Welcome, Jacques.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
We're also joined by Dave Robinson, a former inmate and a graduate of the GRIP program. Dave served 19 years in San Quentin on a three strikes conviction and is now in transition towards regaining life outside of prison. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Jenny Lyon. She's a documentary filmmaker, activist, and surviving victim of violent crime. Jenny served as a citizen lobbyist for the criminal justice reform movement in Texas and has volunteered with the GRIP program for 3 years. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
And as always, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. Midway through the show, we'll open our phone lines. You can take the number down now, though. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you have a question now about how to rehabilitate prisoners and help criminals move away from violence, please send us an email at cityvisions@klw.org. You can do that now. Or go to the klw.org site, and you can post a comment there. So, Jacques Verdun, I wanted to start with you. What drew you to do this work?
Well, it's really a number of things. One is I grew up in Holland, and my father was a prisoner in the war effort. Was forced to do forced labor, and had a pretty rough time. And we used to hear him scream in his sleep as kids and kind of working through some stuff. And when the Berlin Wall came down, he chose to go back, find his captors, and make his peace, which was a bit of a wild idea. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. You didn't leave town, let alone the country. And it's, of course, a longer story, but he did find his captors and some of the surviving people there. And they sat around, and quite without a curriculum, of course, made their peace. And he came back a very different human being. And I guess on that level, I'm his son. You know?
So when did you start the program, and what were you imagining when you first did so?
Well, the program came out of a career of working in prison now for 17 years. And this is really sort of a best practices, a gathering of everything I've learned in those 17 years. And I think perhaps what's unique about it is that it was learned from the inside out. It was learned based on having thousands of prisoners that I've worked with and that I've learned from. So it's very informed from the inside out.
And so what kind of work had you been doing in prisons at the time?
I founded an organization called the Inside Prison Project that I directed for 15 years. Programs we pioneered were programs like victim offender work, yoga, self-inquiry, it's kind of innovative addiction work, and work on violence prevention. So all of that together sort of became the GRIP program. And I set up a small organization called Inside Out, because part of the charges of that organization is to take the work outside, because there's many prisons that have no programs. None of us are getting paid by the state or by the government. It's all raised, and it's a little odd because we strongly feel we're serving public safety, we're preventing re-victimization, and it's a little odd that it's has to be a nonprofit that takes charge of that, because the government is still learning that that's part and parcel of what creates public safety.
And the things you mentioned, like self-inquiry and yoga, things that people wouldn't necessarily imagine would happen in prison. And not to necessarily draw any generalizations, but I'm not sure things that people in prison would necessarily expect to do in prison.
It's true.
So what led you to reach to these tools?
Well, you know, it just didn't seem right to me that part of what creates well-being and creates insight in people is in the hands of the privileged few, you know, sort of the upper white middle class. And so what we did was we took some of those tools and found language and implementation for an incarcerated ethnic population that would otherwise have no access to these tools. And so that is kind of what we've put on the map.
Hmm. And how long has the program been going on now?
In its current configuration, 3 years. But the experience leading up is a total of 17.
Hmm. And how many men have gone through the program so far?
Let's see, we graduated 75 guys last November, and we had primarily, last year we had primarily licensed maximum security violent offenders, people that have served a number of decades in many ways. And the year before we had, let's see, 34 guys graduating, and now we have 75 enrolled, and about 306 on a waiting list.
And it's a year-long program, right?
Yeah.
You know, 375 on a wait list.
306 right
306.
Now. Yeah.
Okay. And we'll talk more about elements of the, sure, the program in just a moment. But I wanted to turn next to Dave Robinson. You're a graduate of the program that we're talking about this evening. And just as I asked Jacques in the beginning, I wanted to find out what drew you to participate in the program that Jacques was advertising.
Well, I went through many, many years of depression, which led me to my offense, which was forgery. Led me to a life sentence. I had a prior burglary and a prior attempted burglary. I was a drug addict. I never had no physical violence, no sexual crime, things like that, but I suffered a major depression, and I medicated for a few years before I picked up those strikes. When I got my life term, I had made a decision the day I was arrested that I had to change my life. I couldn't live that way anymore. I was very desperate. I was hurting. So I sought out every program available in prison to change my life, especially spirituality. I needed to find some spirituality, some understanding of why I hurt so many years. And I took numerous programs nonstop for all the whole years I was in there. And eventually I come across this GRIP program. And what a transformation. Mm-hmm. This program it puts you in an environment where men in prison aren't used to crying or talking about emotional things. In this program, you learn to cry. You see other men cry. You really get in touch with a deep feeling of empathy, compassion, and you also get to understand the different types of violence. You know, without ever striking a person or stabbing or shooting, you hurt people through physical violence, through verbal violence, through sexual violence, financial violence, emotional violence. There's so many different types of violence, and I've always called myself a nonviolent offender. Well, I hurt society, I hurt my children, I hurt my family, I hurt myself, I hurt my victims through my checks. So that's the type of violence. And you get to learn the victim impact through programs, this program here. It's it put me in touch with how I impacted others. And to sit on a prison bunk for 19 years and never hear from your kids or your brothers and sisters or your loved ones and need to hold someone and not have that, that's important to come to grips with that.
So it seems like you are seeking this opportunity out.
I'm seeking any opportunity I can to help another human being to not hurt like I hurt for my entire life. And this program here was medication without taking any pills, without taking any drugs.
So, and how many other programs at the prison had you participated in before you came to the GRIP program?
Innumerable. There's so much. There's such a long list. I have no number on that. It was nonstop for me for 19 years.
And what was different about this one, if anything?
Well, this one here was completely different than any of the other ones because it gave you, when he says inside out, you know, it is. It rebuilds you from the inside out. And you really get in touch with who you are. And that's something that I lacked. I never knew myself. All I knew was pain. So when I got to know myself, I realized, you know, the person that I am today, the person that you have on this show right now, it's the person I was always. I was always this guy. But he was hidden inside of me. And I never knew how to bring him out. And that's what I was hurting about. I didn't know that guy. And this program brought that awareness to me. And I became mindful of everything around me. Everything, all the situations, circumstances, sufferings, compassion, nature. I became aware of everything. And it's an incredible program. It's really an incredible program.
It sounds like it really was a lifesaver.
It is a lifesaver. I couldn't stress that enough. It is a lifesaver.
And what was it like to sit with your fellow inmates at the time and to go through this process? People who you may have known for quite some time and related to in very different ways. What was it like to go into this, what sounds like a very intimate space, a very vulnerable place?
It was very intimate. And we were just discussing that outside. I was in San Quentin for 11 and a half years. That's the longest I have ever had a residence in my life. I'm 62 now. I've never lived anywhere in my life for 11 and a half years. And I've met guys in there that I knew through the whole 11 and a half that were pretty hardcore guys. But once they were going through this program, they would come over to my cell and talk to me about intimate things, about their family, writing letters to their mother, to their daughter, and break out and cry. You know, that's not something that men do in prison. Men aren't really allowed to talk about emotional things, their family and their pain. Guys don't want to hear it. They'll call you a sniveler. You're weak, you know. But this program puts you up and above that. They put you beyond that. They give you insight. You know, they bring empathy. You develop empathy.
Well, definitely want to hear more from you, Dave Robinson, about your specific experiences in the program and how you see this not only in your life but helping the lives of others moving forward. For a moment, though, I want to bring Jenny Lyon into the conversation. And you are a documentary filmmaker, and those of you who are listening on the air can't tell, but we're actually filming this episode of our program tonight. You're an activist. You've lobbied for criminal justice reform in Texas. You yourself have survived a violent crime. And so in many ways, it's not terribly surprising to me that you found your way to the GRIP program. But I'm curious, you know, as a documentarian, right, as an activist, how you made the transformation from wanting to bear witness, wanting to project something that you felt important was important for people to see, to actually becoming a participant rather than just an observer. What got you to join as a, not as a participant the way Dave was, but as perhaps, I don't know, what you would call yourself, a teacher or someone from the outside coming in to reflect on your experience?
Thanks, Joseph. Yes, the way that I kind of came, I actually am coming at this backwards. The documentary is born out of being a participant. That I have found that there's so much value in what we're doing that I feel compelled to share it
with the rest of the country or the rest of anyone who's been touched by the criminal justice entity in America, the mass incarceration that we're dealing with right now, with epidemic levels of violence. Violence impacted my life very personally, and because of that, I was involved in justice reform in Texas. And let me just, so it's not a big elephant in the room, tell everybody that I didn't personally survive the violence, but my mother was murdered when I was 17 years old. And my father is serving life sentence for her death. And he was definitely involved, but I don't think it was as black and white as the state said, premeditated murder and everything. This happened in Texas. You may have heard that the justice system in Texas is quite broken, and that's been my experience. And because of that, I've been very passionate about this since my youth, and I've remained very close with my father. I've gone to visit him in prison for 20 years now. And that's what drew me to restorative justice, which is the kind of work that Jacques is doing with the GRIP program and that Dave is invested in. And that's when it's opposed to being purely punitive, when we take justice and we seek to restore the harm that was caused when a crime occurred. And I discovered that with my father through victim offender mediation dialogues that we set up with my mother's sister. And that was such a healing experience for our family to be able to come together again and talk about what happened. That when I moved to California to study filmmaking, I went to Bioneers and I heard Jacques giving a talk about restorative justice and about the programs that they're doing at San Quentin. And I knew immediately that this was something I wanted to be involved in, that that this is powerful, this has the power to change lives, and so how can I help, how can I serve? And so Jacques has brought me in to work with the inmates at San Quentin to help them understand the impact of violence on the victims, surviving victims like me, when it's the case where the victim is deceased. And I think I do have some insight into what people who have personally suffered violence also go through, because everything that led up to this in my family, I did suffer a lot of violence in my youth, a lot of emotional violence primarily. And so for me, this is about healing. It's about healing personally. And that's also why I'm making this documentary. It's kind of big art therapy, very public art therapy. Call me crazy. But I'm in it to heal. And so my reasons for working with the guys are because I find it incredibly cathartic that my pain and suffering can have meaning, that it can serve a higher purpose than just hurt in my heart that stays there. When I bring it out and I share it with them and they understand what it's like to lose your whole family, what it's like, I also help them understand what it's like to love someone in prison. Every one of these guys has a family. Every one of these guys has left someone on the outside who's suffering from missing them because they love them, wondering how their lives went so astray, wondering, you know, the financial impacts are incredibly hard on families. I forget the exact statistics, but it's staggering how many people in prison have children, and they're left with one parent if they're lucky.
It's so one in 28 school-aged children have a parent incarcerated in the United States.
One in 28.
Mm. And my understanding is that close to one in 100 Americans are incarcerated. And the other statistic, I just happened to be at the TEDx event in Berkeley this weekend, and one of the speakers spoke very poignantly about the other statistic, which is 5% of the population is the United States of the world, and 25% of the prison population worldwide is incarcerated in the United States.
Correct.
So just to throw out a couple of other statistics that can help to ground your very personal experience.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's staggering when we look at the impact that this is having on our American society as a whole.
It's going to be hard to find anyone whose life has not been touched by the criminal justice system before too long when you've got 1 in 28 kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's one in every classroom. That's too many, in my opinion. I feel like a lot of times prison is not the answer for, you know, certainly for nonviolent drug offenses, certainly for, anyway, I don't want to get too political here, but I feel like we're using prison a little bit too loosely. And that has impacts on families, myself included. So that's why I do this work.
Yes, Dave.
Well, I just wanted to throw in another statistic that I read out of the Justice Policy Institute. For every male offender that sits in prison that has a son, there's an 89% chance that that son is going to end up in the system. And, you know, going in, a guy doesn't understand those statistics. But if when you think about that, you're not really giving a son much of a chance. And it's better to prevent these things from happening in some way. I don't have the answers, but somehow we have to find a way to stop all the payback attitude, you know, it's the retribution. We have to get more involved. The restorative justice programs, this GRIP program is amazing. You know, this is turning lives around.
But, you know, there's also, if I may, sound financial footing to change policy. Because it costs $60,000 to incarcerate somebody in a state prison per year.
Yeah, and, you know, the work I try to do as often as I can is I try to help people out there on the streets that are addicted, that are into violent crime. I try to prevent them from ever going to prison. I would rather see a man never go to prison than have to go to prison and learn something while he's in there. I would rather see he learn and not ever go. You know, there's better places for California to spend their money than running 33 adult prisons.
Go ahead.
If I may jump in there, one thing that would have been tremendously helpful in my family's experience would have been more mental health care. I think a lot of people that wind up in prisons these days are suffering from from mental health problems. And if we
it's a shadow mental health system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
it is.
Like these have become our asylums.
Well, there's long lines, incredible. The lines in prison for medication and their side drugs, most of them. Mm-hmm. Are incredible. I mean, there's 200 guys in a line twice a day. You know, and they're getting antidepressants. They're getting, they hear voices. You know, they're getting the Melaril, the Cogentin, whatever it is they get for the Thorazine. They're getting these psych drugs. And the numbers are, you know, for, like I said, I was in for many years, so when you're looking at the numbers when I first got there compared to the numbers that are in there now, you know, I got in there under Pete Wilson. So that was a long time ago. And that's where the guy, he came in there wanting to change the system to open up new drug programs. And it turned out that his drug programs ended up being state prisons.
Wow.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the GRIP program at San Quentin Prison with our guests, Jacques Verdon, founder and director of the program, Dave Robinson, graduate of the program and former inmate at San Quentin, and Jenny Lyon, documentary filmmaker and GRIP volunteer. We open our phone lines now to you, our listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation. 415-841-4134. Have you or a member of your family been a victim of violent crime? Do you have questions about someone you know who is incarcerated now or has been in jail in the past? What questions do you have about how to help criminals move away from violence and for survivors to heal? The number to call is 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment at the KLW website. So I want to bring it back to the details of the program to learn a little bit more about it. So, so Jacques, first I wanted to start with the culture of San Quentin.
Yes.
And you can look at culture from many different perspectives. The culture of the inmates, the culture of the officers and other staff who work there, the culture of the administration. Tell us what you were swimming in as you conceived of this program.
Well, San Quentin actually represents one of the most underreported social experiments that I know of. That prison has changed radically in the last 17 years. And, you know, when you hear Dave talk about taking programs after program, it's like, the only place you could do that is in San Quentin, and it's largely because it's the only prison left in a metropolitan area like this, San Francisco Bay Area. And it's through, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers, not just from my program, but from all kinds of programs, that have changed the culture in there. And that said, you know, you still have to forge a way to get your program going, and it's hard work because you know, we're high on conviction and ideals and low on funds and staff, so the occupational hazard is definitely, you learn a lot of patience.
And how welcome was your idea to start this program?
Well, again, because I already at that time spent 14 years there, there was quite a bit of goodwill there, and so we got a lot of support from the prison and the warden to do what we do. We're actually reaching out to try to spill some of the beans into other places, and so they've allowed us to film one of our classes to make a instructional DVD series, and we're sort of scrambling with film students and the such to do that in a professional way.
And how about from the rest of the staff? Did you see that the staff and the administration kind of were in alignment around the being welcoming to your proposals, or was there a disconnect there?
Well, there's all kinds of staff, right? There's the quintessential sort of old guard perspective that thinks that these guys don't have it coming, and we're all suckers that don't have a life, apparently, so that we're showing up in the prison to help these guys. So there's that, and then there's also the correctional officers that understand that, no, there's a place for this. They've been worked over pretty well by a legion of volunteers. In many other prisons, this is not the case, and there's a real need, not just for more programs. I'm talking with Senator Mark Leno about this. It's not just programs. There needs to be a culture change. There needs to be a whole shift in what it means to serve public safety other than locking people up.
So let's talk a little bit more about the essential elements of the program. Can you can you sort of tour us through the curriculum, as it were?
Yeah, a little bit. It's 52 weeks, so I'll give it a go. There's four elements, really. One is to stop your violence. You know. Number one rule of the universe, do no harm. Learn how to understand what makes one violent, and learn how to stop it. The second element is developing emotional intelligence, learning how to process emotional material that gets in the way of learning new behaviors. The third one is to cultivate mindfulness. We really think that mindfulness is sort of the mother of all interventions there, because if you can shift somebody from having a blind reaction to cultivating a response, that's really the difference between committing a crime or not. And then the fourth element is understanding victim impact, is that the men, after having done a lot of work on themselves, learn to understand how their behavior impacts others, because the whole court system is set up to keep that separate. You actually don't, you know, you don't learn the results of your actions. And so it's a very powerful piece. And you know, it's surprising perhaps to listeners how many men are on waiting lists to deal with some of the most difficult things that there is for them to face there.
Hmm. So this is a potentially broad question, but I hope you can see where I'm going here. What leads the men that you work with to be in prison in the first place, and how is it that what you're doing is rectifying that?
There's two answers that come. One is a little story, a little anecdote, where I had a shot caller for the Cribs in one of my classes. That's slang for somebody who's in charge of a gang named the Cribs. And he sat there with his arm folded, pretty heavy-looking guy, and didn't say very much. And then we put him together with somebody from his neighborhood that he knew from way back and said, you know, we're going to ask you to mentor this youngster. And he came alive. And one day he raised his hand, and I said, what? He said, I got it. I said, well, what did you get? He said, hurt people hurt people. He said, and I know it because, you know, my mother shot my alcoholic father when I was 6 years old, and the police surrounded the home for 20 hours because they didn't know quite what was going on. Then his apprentice raised his hand. He said, I got something too. I said, well, what did you get? He said, healed people heal people. I said, and I know because this man is teaching me how to not be violent. He was there for domestic violence. And then both men wept. And so did the rest of us, pretty much, you know, witnessing this. And those eight words, hurt people, heal people, you know, have become sort of the tagline of our program. It's eight words that describe the whole thing. Now, as to what motivates people to become vulnerable and authentic, I think is we create a learning environment, a learning community that functions much like some of the gangs' work, except that it's constructive instead of destructive. The Navajo have a saying of describing people who engage in criminal behavior as he or she who acts as if they have no relatives. And it points the finger to a lack of social bonding that exists in our society, in our modern society. And guys go look for street love in the wrong places, and, you know, one thing leads to another. So we set up a tribe in the group, and we add up the years of how long everybody has served, and that becomes the name of the tribe. So last year we had one tribe called 936, because these men had together served almost 1,000 years of time, you know, 34 guys. So that learning environment then bonds them and gives them, you know, evokes accountability out of personal significant relationship. And you know, we're all doing time on that one. You don't have to be in prison to be looking and wondering how you belong on this planet. And so these crimes are symptoms of greater social breakdowns. And by just throwing people away and punishing them as individuals, we don't get to learn what these symptoms are expressing. And so after 17 years, you become half of an anthropologist almost. To learn that, hey, wait a minute, this thing has a tail. There is more going on than individual errant behavior here.
Dave, I know you wanted to get in there and say more about how, in some ways, you got to be where you were and what was unlocked in you. Tell us some more about how this program addressed where you've come from and where you want to go next.
Well, that little term that Jocks used, hurt people, that's really the key to understanding everything for me. Because, like I said, I was a very hurt individual. And when I came to terms with... See, when I was disenfranchised from society. I was pretty much disenfranchised from my family. I was a loner, a total loner. I hung out with myself everywhere. And when I went to prison, I got to thinking about that. You know, why did I always feel so lonely? Why did I always hurt so much? I didn't even spend time with my wife. I hurt because of that. Well, eventually, that when I started learning that you know, I'm disenfranchised, I wanted to find the way to franchise. And that's been important for me, and that's been a real big transition for me. And I've recently met somebody new in my life, and I'm in a relationship. I love her, and things are picking up in my life. I've only been out a year. I've got a 3-bedroom house, a car. I've got all my furniture. I've got a little dog. I've got a girlfriend. You know, things are they're wonderful for me. And I couldn't have said this 20 years ago. It didn't matter what I had, because I climbed all the way to the top of the ladder of success, but I always jumped off. I was never happy. But I have found happiness. And when Jacques used that term, hurt people, he also said, healed people, heal people. And that's what I try to do. I try to work to help people. Mm-hmm. I want to stop somebody from going in there and going through what I did. And I work every day as much as I can to help who I can.
If I may ask you a little bit about this burgeoning relationship you're in, how is the relationship currently different from any relationship you may have had in the past?
Openness. Openness. I can be me. I never was able to do that before. You know, I can love somebody openly now instead of just feeling it in my heart and running around the streets. Now I can love somebody openly and express my love. I can express my sorrow to my kids, what I put them through. I can love my sister openly. I've never had a relationship with my sister. She's older than I am. I'm 62. Never had a relationship with my sister. I have a very close relationship with my sister now, and I love her. And, you know, I can say that and feel good about it. And before, I could never say I love you to anybody, you know, except for my children, but I just didn't say I love you. It was hard for me to say that. My parents never said it to me. I never got hugs. My brothers always fought each other, kicked each other in the guts, you know. I'm from a hard, hurting family. But it's easy for me now, you know, where I can get out there, I can tell people I love them. I can meet someone at a store and tell them I love them. Someone who's begging for spare change. You know, I like to say I love you. I enjoy it.
empathy feels good, huh?
I love it. It's my new high.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight on City Visions here on KLW San Francisco. As we talk about the Guiding Rage into Power program at San Quentin State Prison with our guest Jacques Verdun, who founded and directs the program, Dave Robinson, who we're just hearing from just a second ago there, who's graduate of the program and a former inmate at San Quentin, and Jenny Lyon, who's a documentary filmmaker and a GRIP volunteer. 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, or go to the KLW website and post a comment there. So let's go to a couple of callers. Let's see. Let's start with Evan. Evan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I first want to say I really very much agree with the fellow who spoke before me, that the ability to emotionally give and take is probably one of the first things a person who gets involved in the criminal justice system loses, because he can't show weakness, definitely cannot show weakness, and definitely does not want to try to relate to other people in the prison, in the judicial system. Whether it's even a probation officer from there on out, and that what the rage into, I'm sorry if I'm not as up to date on the phraseology, but the turn rage into an ability to communicate emotionally with others is essential. So the reason I called was because I've been on both sides of this, not debate, but of the system. I spent 5 years in prison, including San Quentin, where I spent a year and a half, and Most people don't spend a year and a half in San Quentin. Most people spend their life in San Quentin. The only reason I did was I was on the way to the farm on the outside. I mean, on the outside of the 1850 walls.
Evan, I'm going to ask you to get to your main point, because we have a couple other calls to get to.
And the what is essential is, including the prior speaker's point, was that if prisoners are not allowed to create a to work and to come back into society as working members, you're going to have the recidivism rates of 66%. When I was released from the front gate of San Quentin, there were three people. One was a member of the New Guerrilla family, one was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, and then myself. And the member of the Aryan Brotherhood looked down and said, "This is a $100 check and $100 was going to be a $100 bill." And he said, "This is enough for 38 and a bag of speed." And then he's released into Marin County. Well, you can imagine the pandemonium that results from that. If instead the system was set up to be a productive, in other words, you came in with the only purpose being to both emotionally evolve you and to job-wise evolve you, so that you were able to be a productive member. That was your whole. That was the whole goal of the rehabilitation part that that Governor Brown took out of the system in '75, was put back in. Now, he didn't take it out because he wanted to. He took it out for other reasons. But
yes, Evan. So I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your comment.
Well, is it how important it is? If you don't create a system that creates people ready to work, you're going to create people that are ready to steal, rob, and rip.
Thank you so much for your call. 415-841-4134. Let's go next to RJ. RJ, welcome to the program.
Hi, I was wondering what kind of opportunities there were to volunteer for GRIP.
Jacques, do you want to talk about that?
We're pretty well covered on the kind of volunteering that deals with going into the prison and helping to assist teaching the program. But we could always use volunteers on other levels. We have tasks at the office that relate to writing and editing. We have a need for some assistance with instructional design. We're looking for funds to pay for the new video instructional project, things like that.
And how would RJ find out more about that?
There's a website called Insight, as in INSIGHT, Insight, dash out. And it's a, there's videos and there's interviews, and it's a pretty lively website, and there's a lot of information about all that.
Great. Thanks so much, RJ, for your call. So, Jenny, I want to bring you back into the conversation. One of the pieces that Jacques outlined, he mentioned stopping violence, emotional intelligence, mindfulness, and victim impact. I'm curious, now that you've volunteered for a while, what is your take on how vital this is and how victim impact awareness should be part of the experience of people who are incarcerated, and how to do it safely so that people can not be re-victimized but heal and go through the process. Although it doesn't sound like the process, the way it's set up, would be victimizing, but in the sense that, you know, as people re-engage past experiences, there's lots to grapple with there. Lots comes out.
Undoubtedly, it is a very emotional experience for a volunteer like me, who's there to help the inmates understand the impact of violence on surviving victims like myself, or someone who is directly victimized, like a rape victim, for example. And one way that I think is really brilliant that GRIP does is they have surrogate victims like me. So I was not directly victimized by anyone in the groups that I work with. My father is serving in Texas, and I wish he could have access to a program like this to help him really grapple with some of these issues of emotional accountability for the impact that his choices have had on our family. And I'm grateful to be able to give that kind of an experience to people like him, because so far, every group that I've worked with at San Quentin, there has been at least one man in the group who is incarcerated for killing his wife. And not necessarily under the same circumstances, obviously, as my family, but close enough that I can really help them understand what their children have gone through and what they continue to go through by feeling their grief just so conflicted over loving their father and yet being incredibly angry by what has happened and the loss that they've suffered. The way that that's helpful to me and as part of my healing process, because, you know, what the guys very insightfully understand about how hurt people, but healed people heal people. That's true for me too. I'm hurting terribly from what happened to my family. But by helping to heal these guys, I help to heal myself. So in that way, it's a very safe and respectful environment that I walk into. By the time I get there, this is like toward the end of their year-long program, they have done a lot of the hard-hitting inner work so that they can really show up emotionally available to what I have to share with them. And yes, it is a little confrontational. They are a little afraid that I'm going to throw a whole lot of anger their way. And it's there. They really need to have their feet held to that fire, because that fire burns. But they've learned how to sit in the fire. That's one of the practices that they learn in the GRIP program, sitting with really painful emotions and letting them burn you clean emotionally. So we do a little bit of that when I work with the guys. And then after I've told them how hard it is to be on the victim side, that's when I bring in the part about being a secondary victimization that occurs to their families, and help them understand how their own children feel, how their own wives feel to have lost the breadwinner, to have lost their dad or their husband or their brother. It's important for them to understand that the victim impact is not just the person they directly victimized, but also mm-hmm. their own families and their communities.
So, Jacques, I'm compelled by this mm-hmm. concept of sitting in the fire, and I'm curious how I imagine in your skilled hands that you lead people through this process. Tell us a little bit more about what it means to sit in the fire,
right.
And also how you help people manage what might be a flood of emotions
right.
And perhaps guilt
mm-hmm.
and shame amongst those. Mm-hmm. How do you help them take that process through to the place where it, as you said, it burns clean.
Right, and leaves ashes.
Hmm.
Right, because the opposite of ashes is that you are in reaction to the original pain, the traumatic pain. And that reaction often is some form of medication, either through substance or behavior, anything you can do in excess, to avoid feeling that original pain. And that sets up a production of a cycle of new pain that could easily be a lifetime. So in sitting in the fire, we've developed a meditation, a technique, a practice, wherein participants learn how to tolerate overwhelming emotion, you know, for example, the loss of a beloved, you know, one part of the curriculum says there's basically four strategies. You can run, you can hide, you can fight, or you can face. And this one's about facing. And many of us, you know, some of us were lucky, didn't get caught, in our younger years, explored those strategies into some detail, right? But in the practice, you learn how to take a bite out of it. You know, you don't burn clean in one fell swoop. It's a practice, and you do it together. And it is not about, you know, toughening it up and manning up and sucking it up. It's actually the opposite. It's about learning that you can handle it, you know, because often what is said, you know, the prison national anthem that I've written has two words. It's called F it, you know. They don't care, nobody cares. I don't care, F it. You know, it's just the very thing you say before you relapse. And so, you know, when you look closely, it's not so much that you can't take it anymore. It's either I won't take it anymore, which is a little more honest, or I don't know how to take this, and let's learn. And let's learn how to tolerate these sensations and these emotions in such a way that they can be felt and pass on through. Because what we've learned is, you know, the journey of processing an emotion is that it has to go in through and out. And when that happens, you sit in the fire, you burn clean, and you leave ashes.
Hmm. So, Dave, tell us briefly how you've taken some of the practices, the mindfulness, the sitting in the fire, facing your emotions in a way that's not overwhelming or destructive. How have you taken that into your current life?
Well, being very open with people, that's a big key. But sitting in the fire was a big part of the class because it puts you in touch with your inner feelings, and you're able to bring that out in front of other people. And where before you couldn't do that. We read letters in front of everybody and outside guests that come in, volunteers that work in there. We got 40 to 50 people in a big circle, you know, and somebody will sit in front of that circle or right in the middle of that circle and read a heart-wrenching letter that they wrote themselves about their life experience. And, you know, I can't really remember any one person that did not cry during their letter reading. I did. I cried. And it's okay to cry. And the mindfulness, to get into the mindfulness part of it, that's the important part, because that's what puts you in touch. When I was speaking earlier about being aware of the impact that this had on my children and the impact it had on society and my sisters, my brothers, my wife, ex-wife at the time. I was divorced when I offended. But it still had an impact on everybody. I have two stepchildren that call me dad still to this day, and they see me on a regular basis. I was a good dad. I really was. I hid my addiction as much as I could. But the mindfulness, that's important, because when you get mindful, you become aware of everything. You know, your empathy comes in, your compassion comes in, your understanding comes in, why you've been through what you've been through, why you did what you did, why you feel today the way you feel today. You know, it goes on and on. It's being mindful, it's being aware of everything.
So I wanted to turn to some statistics, perhaps, Jacques, that you may be keeping about the impact of this program. What have you seen so far, and how are you? What are you measuring, and what are you following? What are you looking for?
Well, of course, the sacred cow here is recidivism, right? And so I've seen a pattern over 17 years of elements of the group program that we've done that is very encouraging, and of everybody who has graduated, no one has reoffended. And, you know, that's pretty striking in this business.
That's amazing.
And with what I mentioned in the beginning of the program, with 65% of parole prisoners ending back up in custody within 3 years.
Right.
Well, when you got it,
doesn't take long to see those effects.
When you have a 0%, that's pretty astonishing.
That is my
but you know, also to understand that this isn't just a phenomenon that only deals with incarceration, right? I think it's important to see that a huge number of resources go to something that doesn't work. It's a system that profits off its own failure, and it eats its young in the process. Once you're in on probation as a youngster, it's very hard to get out. And so there is another way, and it isn't us and them. It's everybody can win on this. But particularly for those not humanitarily inclined, you can save millions, billions of dollars if the money that can go to education. I have a kid that needs to go to college, and I'm pretty staggered what's asked of me to, you know, pay for that. And so, you know, take Dave here, right? They've got a three strike, if I may I talk about that?
Sure.
They've got a third strike that he did 18, 19 years over, forging two checks. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so he got 50 years to life for that. So suppose the voters hadn't elected to overturn three strikes, and Dave would be doing 50 years. That costs $3 million at the current rate. For a check, what was the check for?
One check was for $218. One check was for $368.
Right.
So I would like to say thank you to every voter out there that voted to change that law.
So Jacques, the economic argument may be compelling for many. How about, and maybe was the reason why the repeal of three strikes was on the ballot in the first mm-hmm. place, but have you heard or do you imagine if you try to spread your program outside of San mm-hmm. Quentin, outside of the Bay Area, that you might be hearing a different refrain, which is, no, these people that are in prison really need to be here to be punished and to pay for their crime? How would you respond to that?
I think that's, you know, I'm happy to say that it is very rapidly changing a lot. That, you know, a recent survey from the Public Policy Institute had it that 70% wants to spend less on prisons and more on education.
It's a culture.
And so, you know, the pendulum is swinging, and there's a lot of demand we have for the program, both in the state, out of state, and abroad even. And so we're in a year of capacity building, so we can handle the demand that's out there.
And Jenny, as we're almost ready to close out the show, can you add to that?
I'd just like to speak to the point about punishment. I think a lot of people assume that victims want the offenders to be punished, and they want them to pay for their crimes. And as I've found personally, and also as you'll find through, you know, lots of famous people speak out against, like, the death penalty, for example, a lot of victims are opposed to the death penalty. A lot of victims, like myself, are opposed to life sentences, that throwing people away is not does not bring a sense of justice to our family, that my father has been sentenced to life in prison. That does not feel like justice to us. So I think I just want to correct any popular misconception out there that all victims want their offender locked away for life. That's not the case.
So, Jacques, as we close out the program, what are the next phases for not only this program at San Quentin, but in other California mm-hmm. state prisons? And what is that looking like? How are you going to build capacity here?
Right. Well, I think the legislature has to get involved. You know, I think there's, and the governor, who I think it was alluded to in this program, in his first run as governor, changed some laws that made it so that people were in prison for decades and decades and decades. And so I think there's a dignity for all of us to be found in how we address this problem. You know, I think it was Dostoevsky who said something about that it's all of our charge to learn how to be worthy of our suffering. You know, some of that suffering that you receive and some that you've doled out. And so I think there's a lot to be gained, and there's a lot of invisible pain that could be addressed in overturning our prison system and reforming it.
And do you see exporting this model in other places? Are there plans for that right now?
Yes, there are plans for that. We are doing the instructional video series. We're having a workbook that's almost complete, and we're training 15 inmate facilitators that we would like to employ gainfully, exactly like that.
Well, thanks so much to my guests, Jacques Verdon, who's the founder and director of the GRIP program, Dave Robinson, a graduate of the program, and Jenny Lyon, a volunteer. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe. We'll be off next week for President's Day and return on February 24th. For my co-host, David Onick, this is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.